talk about biologically massive ADS gravity.
Okay, I'm going to talk about a theory that is probably, in the end, not very interesting. Now, that's probably not that unusual, but it's a little unusual for a speaker to admit that at the beginning. So let me start by explaining why I'm talking about this. I've chosen this topic because topologically massive ADS gravity is a theory that looks very much as if it ought to be interesting. It's one of these theories where you start doing calculations and all sorts of miracles happen. And you get nice cancellations and things that could go wrong suddenly seem to not go wrong. You really get the feeling that there must be something deep going on there. Unfortunately, in the end, it is almost certainly true, although I'll talk about a few remaining loopholes at the end, that the theory is really sick. And so a student suggested that, let's see if I can get this to work, that my title really should be a eulogy for topologically massive ADS gravity. So topologically massive gravity is a theory of gravity in three space-time dimensions. So I should start by saying a little bit about why three-dimensional gravity might be worth interest, worth thinking about, given the noteworthy fact that we don't live in three space-time dimensions. Well, quantum gravity is hard, and it's hard partly for some deep conceptual reasons, but partly for some technical reasons. The main technical reason is that the phase space of general relativity, the space of solutions of the theory of the field equations, or the space of initial data once the constraints are satisfied, is really messy. And since when you quantize a theory, what you're quantizing is the classical phase space, when you have a theory where you really don't understand the classical phase space very well, it makes it technically very hard to quantize. And those technical problems get in the way of some of the underlying interesting conceptual issues. Three-dimensional gravity has a much nicer phase space. It is classically exactly soluble, has a finite number of degrees of freedom, which in many cases can be characterized exactly and completely. And this makes it a good model for getting the technical stuff out of the way and looking at these underlying conceptual problems. In addition, with a negative cosmological constant, it's a theory that has interesting black holes. So you can ask about the microphysics of Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, for instance. And it is a very nice playground for the ADS-CFT correspondence because the dual conformal field theory to a three-dimensional bulk theory is two-dimensional, and two-dimensional conformal field theory, two-dimensional conformal symmetry is much more powerful than it is in other dimensions. And so you can determine a great deal about the conformal field theory. So that's why three-dimensional gravity is worth looking at. There are also some reasons why it's not such a good model. And the first two of these are the same as the first two reasons that I gave on the previous transparency. Because it is exactly soluble classically, and because it has a finite number of degrees of freedom, in particular, it has no local propagating degrees of freedom. And that means that a lot of interesting questions that face you in more realistic quantum gravity, how to construct local operators to reflect the obvious local dynamics that we see when there can be no diffeomorphism invariant local operator, those problems don't show up in these models. There's another peculiarity. This is maybe a reason why it's not a good model, but maybe it's a reason why it's a more interesting model to try to understand better, which is that there's a problem with the ADS-CFT correspondence that was pointed out by first, I think, Witten and Maloney the end of last year. If you stick in a negative cosmological constant so that 2 plus 1 dimensional gravity is asymptotically anti-de Sitter, the boundary, the conformal boundary, looks like a cylinder. And you can sum over all topologies of space-time that fill in that cylinder with fixed boundary conditions, for instance, fixed energy, fixed mass. What Witten and Maloney pointed out was that if you do that, you end up with something which is supposed to be the partition function of a two-dimensional conformal field theory, but which is not, which doesn't have the right asymptotics to be the partition function of any conformal field theory. So there's something missing here, something mysterious going on. And one of the possible solutions that Witten and Maloney and independently, in a slightly different context, Manshot pointed out, is that if you could somehow take this theory and split it into two chiral sectors, a left moving and right moving sector, and treat them independently and sum over topologies for the left moving modes and separately over topologies for the right moving modes, then you would get something that seemed to look like a very nice conformal field theory partition function. So this suggests that somehow it would be useful to understand more about how to split the theory into left and right moving modes. Now, that's a split that violates parity. And so to do that, it's natural to look at a theory that inherently violates parity from the beginning. So that's one of the motivations for topologically massive gravity, the other being that it has nice propagating degrees of freedom. So here's topologically massive gravity as first introduced by Desert, Jakeev, and Templeton. You start with the ordinary Einstein-Hilbert action with the negative cosmological constant. And then you add a Chern-Simons action for the ordinary Riemannian connection. So, and then you just add these two actions with a coupling constant, 1 over mu, where mu has dimensions of mass. Let me stress that when you do this, you're treating the connection as a function of the metric, not as an independent variable. And as a result, the Chern-Simons term has 3 derivatives in it, and the field equations that you get are third-order equations. They take the form that the Einstein tensor is basically equal to the Cotton tensor, which is a set of derivatives of the Einstein tensor. So you get third-order equations of motion. Any solutions of the pure gravity, the ordinary Einstein field equations, are automatically solutions of topologically massive gravity. But in addition, there is now a propagating mode that has a mass that's determined by this coupling constant mu. So we have a theory that's three-dimensional gravity, has the black holes and many of the other nice features, but now also has local propagating degrees of freedom. Now, we know in general that when you have a third-order set of field equations, that's dangerous, that you potentially can have ghosts or negative energy states. And in fact, that is a real danger here. If you take the ordinary sign for Newton's constant, then you just do a calculation in the linearized theory, and you find that the propagating massive mode has negative energy. and as far as we can tell, as an energy that's unbounded below. So it looks as if the theory is unstable. In the absence of a cosmological constant, there's an easy way out of this, which is just to flip the sign of Newton's constant. Now, normally you aren't supposed to do that because that would normally make the ordinary gravitational modes negative energy. But since there aren't any propagating gravitational modes here, you can probably, although I'll come back to this at the end, do that safely. That's okay. You don't flip the sign of the matter field. But there is no ordinary gravitational attraction between masses at rest in pure three-dimensional gravity. So.
Can you go back to the equations and give us a feeling where the local degrees of freedom are coming from? Because naively I would think that the part coming from the Chern-Simons Lagrangian should not contribute locally to the dynamics.
Right. Yeah. If you treat the connection as an independent variable, then you get a different set of field equations in which there are no local degrees of freedom. It's the constraint that this connection is the ordinary metric connection that gives you the higher derivatives, and the extra degree of freedom comes from the fact that you have one more derivative. Yeah.
Since you have G in both the action terms, why does the sign matter?
Oh, because you can flip the sign G there and then flip the sign of mu here. So the G in this term is purely conventional. I mean, that it just makes some equations easier to write later. But, well, the reason the sign matters, though, I may have misstated that. The reason that the sign of G here matters is that when you write down the energy, you get something that's to first order, when you write down the energy of a linearized fluctuation around ADS, you get something which looks like an integral of two derivatives of H times 1 over G from the action. So changing the sign of G changes the sign of the energy. Yeah?
The only reason you care whether the energy is positive or negative is because you assume somewhere in the universe there's positive energy matter.
Right.
So if there's any negative energy other stuff, then
right. Yes.
So, but you've got no matter.
Exactly. Yes, I agree. And that's why you can just flip the sign, and it's just conventional because we're used to talking about energy as being positive. There's nothing wrong with the theory that has energy that's purely negative and bounded above. But
just leave it and say, yeah. Have the energy that's bounded above,
yeah. Yeah. Right. However, which nicely brings me to the next point, if you have a negative cosmological constant, you also have BTZ black holes. And the sign of G for which the energy of these propagating modes is positive also has, for that sign, the mass of the black holes is negative. You choose a conventional positive sign for G, then black holes have positive mass, but then the propagating modes have negative mass. And so then, and the theory is interacting, and so then you really do have probably even classically an instability, although I have to say that nobody has written down an exact solution showing a negative mass black hole radiating massive gravitons and having its mass decrease. There certainly seems to be nothing that would prevent such a solution from existing. So while the theory might be okay if the cosmological constant is zero or positive, because there aren't black holes in that case, when you have a negative cosmological constant, there's at least a real danger here. Well, at the beginning of the year, Lee Sung and Strominger pointed out that at a special value of this coupling mu, namely mu equals plus or minus 1 over L, the cosmological constant is minus 1 over L squared, there are a whole lot of interesting cancellations and interesting coincidences, and they suggested that perhaps at this critical coupling, the problem goes away. So let me say a couple of words about why this coupling might be nice, why this particular value might be nice. First of all, in 2 plus 1 dimensional asymptotically anti de Sitter gravity, you can look at the asymptotic symmetries. And since the asymptotic boundary of the spacetime is this nice two-dimensional cylinder, you expect that maybe those should be two-dimensional, the group of two-dimensional diffeomorphisms, that is the Virasoro algebra. You do the calculation, you find that that is in fact the case. And as Krauss and Larson and Solodukhin separately showed a few years ago, if you work out the central charge of these Virasoro algebras, you get two, one basically corresponding to left moving modes and one to right moving modes. The central charges are 3L over 2G, which is the central charge for pure gravity, times 1 plus or minus 1 over mu L. So at mu L equals plus or minus 1, one of those central charges is 0. This suggests certainly that there's something interesting going on in the two-dimensional conformal field theory. In some sense, half of the degrees of freedom are disappearing. It means that a large set of diffeomorphisms, which you weren't allowed to extend to the boundary in pure gravity, you now can. The central charge is an obstruction to extending diffeomorphisms all the way to the boundary. But if one of the central charges is 0, the obstruction disappears. So that's one hint that there's something interesting going on. A second hint comes from looking at linear perturbation theory around an anti de Sitter background. There, in a particular gauge, in harmonic gauge, you can work out the field equations, and they come out as a nice product of three linear differential operators. These two, degrees of freedom annihilated by d plus or minus are the degrees of freedom corresponding to excitations in ordinary pure gravity without the Chern-Simons term. As I said, any solutions of pure Einstein gravity are also solutions of topologically massive gravity. And the third differential operator, dm, has a set of modes that correspond to these massive propagating degrees of freedom. Well, at mu equals plus or minus L, dm becomes equal to one of these, d plus or d minus, which means at first sight that where you originally had three sets of modes, that now you only have two. Two of the modes have become identical. Furthermore, they've become identical to ordinary pure gravity modes. They're no longer these massive excitations. And as it turns out, because the central charge, one of the central charges is 0, one of the two remaining pure gravity modes can be gauged away completely. That means that the theory that you end up with looks as if it's chiral. It looks as if you have only one handedness of mode left, which suggests that maybe it's a nice framework for looking at this problem I talked about earlier. Now, life is not so simple. Grumiller and Johansson showed that there that at mu L equals plus or minus one, a new mode appears, which is annihilated by, for instance, d plus squared, but not d plus. But that mode asymptotically goes in standard Poincaré coordinates, that mode asymptotically goes as log z near the boundary. The solutions are still asymptotically anti de Sitter, but they don't obey a stronger set of boundary conditions, Befferman-Gram boundary conditions, which are at least popular and which one might argue are the correct boundary conditions to impose. More recently, Jirabek, Kleban, and Parati have shown that descendants of this new mode really do seem to obey the full Befferman-Gram boundary conditions. And if they're right about that, then maybe these miracles go away. But this is the question that I set out to investigate, partly in collaboration with Stanley Deser, Andrew Waldron, and Derek Weiss, and partly with some ongoing work with the student Russell Cosgrove.
When you say something goes like 1z, you say it's ADS.
Well, the ADS metric goes as 1 over z squared. So what I mean is that
you've seen the leading term is the same?
I mean, there are various technical definitions of conformal packets. Yeah. The reason I'm saying that is that I don't remember them immediately, but there are some technical definitions of a conformal compactification that require certain behavior of the metric, and the log z perturbations do obey that. What's required basically is that z squared times the metric is regular and has a good normal derivative at the boundary. For Penrose compactification.
Presumably, when you have a field equation, there's always two means, one which is expanding to infinity, and one which is less expanding.
Yeah.
No, and that's the second one. You have a scalar field, two scalar.
Yeah. Is that what I get of my dad as a non
normal? Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, we can certainly talk about this later, and I'll see how much I can remember.
If this miracle did happen and these other modes are not there,
right,
does it mean that there are no local degrees of freedom again?
Although it certainly looks as if it does. I mean, your first reaction is, well, it means that there are no local degrees of freedom because the only modes are these modes that are already there in the pure gravity theory. It's trickier than that, but let me get to this as we go. Okay. It has to do with how you treat non-normalizable modes. But I'll get to that. Okay, so if you want to understand the degrees of freedom of a theory, the first place to look is to look at the constraints, because that gives you the count of the degrees of freedom. And when I started looking at this, I had just heard a talk by Andy Srominger, and I thought, oh, that's beautiful. I'll bet I can prove that. I'll bet that I can go look at the constraints and show that at this special chiral coupling, one constraint maybe changes from first class to second class, or second class to first class. I guess second class to first class, and some degrees of freedom go away. Now, the constraint analysis for this theory is hard because it's a third order theory. It has a bunch of second class constraints. It gets really messy really fast if you try to do this in the metric formalism. There are a couple of papers that did this for the case of zero cosmological constant. They typically involve equations that take up two or three journal pages just to write the constraints. If you go to a first order form and you're clever in your choice of variables, it turns out that things become much simpler. So let me write this in first order form in terms of a triad and a spin connection. But now I'll treat the triad and the spin connection as independent initially. So I can write down the ordinary Einstein-Hilbert action, which involves both. I can write down the Chern-Simons action for the spin connection. I can write down the action for topologically massive gravity, which is just the sum of the two. But then I put in a constraint, a Lagrange multiplier beta, that ensures that the spin connection is the spin connection for that particular triad. This is a constraint that the torsion is zero. In the metric formalism, it's a constraint that the connection is the ordinary Christoffel connection. Technical detail, if you choose a new connection, which is a linear combination of the spin connection and the triad, the equation, the action and the equations of motion split up very nicely. You get a Chern-Simons action for the new connection, a new term that involves just beta and E, where the new connection only occurs in a covariant derivative. And as a result, you get a nice split in your Poisson brackets. This in the Chern-Simons action that tells you, if you look at the time derivatives, that the two spatial components of A are canonically conjugate. And over here, this tells you that beta and E are canonically conjugate. A lot of the technical difficulties before this came from the fact that the Poisson brackets weren't diagonalized this way. And so you got really screwy, just complicated brackets. When you write the action in this form, you find that A0, beta0, and E0 are all Lagrange multipliers. And so you get three sets of constraints, this one from A0, this from E0, and this from beta0. You work out the Poisson brackets of the constraints, which now turn out not to be too complicated. You can fit them on half a journal page. And you find that there's one secondary constraint, one new constraint that comes from the Poisson brackets of the previous constraint. I've called that delta. If you translate these back to the metric formalism, J is the generator of local Lorentz transformations. B is basically the generator of diffeomorphisms, actually some linear combination of B and T. T is the torsion constraint, the constraint that tells you that the connection and the metric are compatible. And then the secondary constraint, delta, is the constraint that the Einstein tensor is symmetric. That I mean that there is zero, that they are equations of motion so that they're equal to zero and that they have no second time derivatives. So they are restrictions on initial data, not evolution equations. Well, in pure Einstein gravity, yes. In topologically massive gravity in this first order form, there is something that you can construct as the Einstein tensor from the metric, which is automatically symmetric. There's something else that you can construct from this Lagrange multiplier beta, which is equal to the Einstein tensor on shell, and which is not necessarily symmetric. Okay, so given these constraints, you can work out their Poisson brackets. As I said, it turns out not to be too complicated. you find that there are six first-class constraints, that is, six constraints whose brackets are proportional to the constraints themselves. These are J, the generator of local Lorentz transformations, and a thing I'm calling B hat, which I haven't written down in detail here, but which is just a linear combination of B and T and corresponds to the generator of diffeomorphisms. There are four second-class constraints, that is, constraints whose Poisson brackets are not proportional to constraints. That's the three torsion constraints and this new constraint delta. So the standard counting of degrees of freedom, you have 18 initial fields. You have E beta, you have A, E, and beta. Each give you two spatial components times three values of the gauge index. So that's 18 fields. Each first class constraint removes 2 degrees of freedom because it is both a constraint and the generator of a gauge invariance. And each second class constraint removes 1 degree of freedom. You find that you end up with 2 phase space degrees of freedom. That is one configuration space degree of freedom, one free propagating degree of freedom. And the unfortunate thing about this is that this is true for all values of the coupling. The structure of the constraints changes slightly at this chiral coupling mu L equals plus or minus 1, but the algebra doesn't. Now, one way to check this is to look at the asymptotic symmetries, which you can get in a variety of ways, many of which were done before, but which you can get in particular by looking at the boundary terms in the algebra of the constraints. So if you assume, if you take a nice coordinate system near the ADS boundary, you look at asymptotic diffeomorphisms that preserve the metric at the boundary, you find that they're parameterized by two functions, one of phi plus t and one of phi minus t, so one left moving, one right moving. You find that the constraints split up into two sets of three, which I've called L plus and L minus. And that when you work out the algebra, including all of the boundary terms, that these form a nice pair of Virasoro algebras with central charges that are exactly the ones that Krauss and Larsson and Soloducan had found earlier from completely different approaches. You also can find the classical conformal weights, that is the value of the conserved charges associated with these constraints. And you find that those are equal to the results that you get for ordinary, for pure Einstein gravity times 1 plus or minus 1 over mu L. So certainly at mu L equals plus or minus 1, interesting things happen. It's true one of the central charges goes to 0. It's true that one of the sets of conformal weights goes to 0. What's not true is that the number of local degrees of freedom jumps.
Okay, but yep. So you always have one.
Yeah.
So it looks like it's always chiral, if anything. Since it is only one.
Well, yeah, this is depends a little bit on what you mean by chiral here. At the boundary, although you have, consider the case of just a single scalar field in asymptotically empty de Sitter space. That's 1 degree of freedom. But if you look at the boundary, it has the stress energy tensor has a plus plus and a minus minus component. So it's not chiral in that sense. While here, what this is really saying is that the stress energy tensor has only a, say, a plus plus component and not a minus minus. Yeah, at the chiral values.
Okay. So there's no polarization of this massive graviton.
Right. It is a, well, in three dimensions, this is gets really tricky because a field of any spin can be represented in terms of one independent degree of freedom. If you look at the angular momentum, you can calculate the angular momentum, and that's non-zero. But so it's three. This is one of the cases. Three dimensions is a little strange. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, so if you're counting degrees of freedom, so a peculiar kind of thing happens because one of the central charges goes to zero, but the other one is double. So what's happening is that somehow the number of degrees of freedom is staying the same, but they're all being shifted into one chirality. So for example, if you look at the entropy of a black hole, you find that that's independent of mu, but it's independent because you get separate contributions from the left moving and right moving pieces, and they move together in such a way that the total remains constant. So again, it's something very interesting going on here. Somehow you are shifting from two chiralities, you're sort of moving one into the other. If you look at black holes, you find that at this critical coupling, all black holes are extremal. But because either m plus j or m minus j goes to zero, because that's one of these charges, but that the number stays the same, that you somehow have twice as many extremal black holes.
I don't quite understand. You count the degrees of freedom in two ways. One is sort of locally using the constraints, and then one is infinity.
Mm-hmm.
It comes out the same. So, do we believe it has to come out the same, or is this something we would like if ABSCFT is correct? Or what's the relation between those two?
There's a difference between bulk degrees of freedom and degrees of freedom at infinity. What I've calculated here using the constraint algebra is the bulk degrees of freedom. And that's coming out, the right way to say that it is that it's coming out one degree of freedom per point. Now at infinity, you get new degrees of freedom. For example, in the case of pure gravity, the number of bulk degrees of freedom per point is zero. But the number of boundary degrees of freedom is presumably very large because the black hole can have a very large entropy. That what's going on there is that because of these central charges, the algebra of diffeomorphisms is you can sort of think of it as saying that the diffeomorphism algebra is broken at infinity. More precisely, the generators of diffeomorphisms that extend to infinity and that don't fall enough off fast enough at infinity, those generators become second class, and as a result, those transformations are no longer gauge symmetries, they're ordinary symmetries. So that gives you room for a large number of degrees of freedom that live purely on the boundary.
So you're not claiming there has to be any particular connection between... Something happens there that would be analogous.
No, I don't think that there's a connection. I mean, I think that Well, if you look at what happens to this central charge, if I put in all of the H bars, this is order 1 over H bar. If you look at what happens when you add in a propagating degree of freedom, that gives you a contribution of order 1. So it's a tiny correction, which is not going to show up at this level of classical Poisson brackets.
So you've just investigated two entirely different questions. One is local degrees of freedom.
Right.
And one is degrees of freedom.
Yes. But the second of these also gives a nice check that the result for the local degrees of freedom is probably right, because the analysis at infinity can be done in 3 or 4 different ways, and they all give the same answer.
Check in the sense that there's no jump in either one.
Yeah. Well, also in check in the sense of being relatively sure that I didn't make any stupid mistakes. Which has been known to happen, sad to say. Okay, so is there a way out of this? Well, maybe. The constraint analysis tells you the number of local degrees of freedom, but it doesn't include boundary conditions. And maybe you can, maybe if you look at boundary conditions, you find that it's at this special value, the boundary conditions exclude some of these solutions, which might be allowed locally. Now, this is tricky because they're propagating degrees of freedom. I'll get to this in a minute. Your gut reaction should be, no, that really can't be. But let me talk about this a little more. So this is work that I did with Deser, Waldron, and Weiss. We started with background anti-de Sitter space in Poincaré coordinates, which in retrospect was not the best choice because these don't cover the full anti-de Sitter space. They only cover one patch. But they certainly make calculations a lot easier. So we start with this metric. We look at fluctuations with various gauge choices, light front gauge, where anything with a minus index is 0, or Pfefferman-Gram gauge, where anything with a z index is 0. So let's start with the light front gauge. If you simply plug in this expansion back into the topologically massive gravity action with an arbitrary mu and do some algebra, you find that in the end there's only one independent degree of freedom, but there is exactly one. It's proportional to H plus plus in this gauge. And its action is the action for a scalar field in anti-de Sitter space with a mass squared that's related to this parameter mu, and which can go down for some values of mu to m squared equals minus 1. Now, m squared equals minus 1 is allowed in three-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. It is the lower bound of mass. It's what's called the Breitloner-Friedman bound. The theory is consistent for m squared all the way down to minus 1, but no lower. Now, the problem with that result, that shows you that you do have this one nice free degree of freedom, at least to first order and perturbation theory. But it looks very gauge dependent. So you can look for a gauge independent formulation by looking at the linearized Einstein tensor. And you find that the components of the linearized Einstein tensor each obey a separate scalar field equation. They aren't all independent because they're related by the Bianchi identities. But looking at each one individually, again, you find a nice scalar field equation with a set of masses that depend on the chirality. This is not quite as weird as it sounds because, again, three-dimensional anti-de-Sitter space is strange. If you look at the Green's functions for a scalar with an arbitrary mass go all the way out to the forward light cone. There's always some piece of a scalar with any mass that's propagating at the speed of light. But still, it's an interesting and somewhat strange result.
All of those are gauge dependent but one?
No, they are all gauge independent.
There's five massive modes or six?
They're gauge independent. They're not independent of each other.
Oh,
I'm sorry. Only one of those is independent.
Right. Yes. Slide.
Well, the one I had on the previous slide was the metric. These are the linearized Einstein tensors. But yeah, all but you can choose any one of these and determine all of the others from it. You can now ask about the curvature asymptotics. And again, at z equals 0, which is most of the boundary of this Poincaré coordinate patch, you find that all of the components of the Einstein tensor fall off rapidly with z, which means that there's nothing bad happening asymptotically here. Well, no. At mu equals 1, there are some extra symmetries that get rid of the z equals 0. That's why I have this as a separate column. This really is 2 and not 0. The solutions can be written in terms of Bessel functions, and there's some extra symmetry. The problem with this is that there's an additional piece of the ADS boundary at z goes to infinity, which we had not considered in our original version of the paper, and Andy Strominger firmly corrected us on that. And at z equals infinity, the individual modes here don't look as if they're behaving so well. It looks as if maybe they are diverging. So maybe that's a way out. Well, no. Here's what you can do. Take this one independent piece of the metric from the field equations, from the action written in terms of this piece, or from the full symplectic form on the full topologically massive gravity theory evaluated in this gauge, you find that there is a natural conserved inner product here. You can define a set of orthonormal modes just as you would for an ordinary scalar field theory. The inner product of an arbitrary mode is going to be, an arbitrary solution is going to be a sum of the orthonormal modes with various coefficients, A and A star. The inner product is not positive definite, but that's just because this is like a Klein-Gordon theory. The positive and energy and negative energy solutions have different inner products. But when you do this analysis, it all looks like an ordinary scalar field theory. And in particular, you can calculate the energy for some mode as a sum of these, for some solution as a sum of these orthonormal modes. It is negative definite and can clearly be made well behaved and finite just by a choice of the coefficients A. Now, I'll get to the significance of this in just a minute. I'll have more to say about this in just a minute. But let me first close one more loophole, which is that this calculation was done in light front gauge. In light front gauge, some of the components of the metric, well, there's only one independent one, the remaining components can be non-local functions of the independent component. So maybe there's something in that non-locality that saves you. Maybe even if things look nice for this one component, which is just like a scalar field, that because of the non-locality, the other components behave badly, and there's an excuse to throw them away. Well, to answer that, and this is so far unpublished work, you can look at the Pfefferman-Graham gauge, that is the gauge in which any component of the metric fluctuation with a z in it is zero. So you just have h plus plus, h plus minus, and h minus minus left. Then here's the result. Take a scalar field. It's 1 over z cubed times an ordinary canonically normalized scalar field. And write the three components of h, the three independent non-zero components of h, not independent, as derivatives of this field x. Then you can just check the field equations, and you find that this always gives you a solution of the field equations for topologically massive gravity. This scalar field x has some nice simple symplectic structure, really various z derivatives of x that have the canonically conjugate, ordinary canonically conjugate plus on brackets, but that's fine. And here, you've written out all of the fluctuations of all of the components of the metric fluctuation explicitly in terms of derivatives of this scalar field. So what does this mean? It means you can start with arbitrary initial data on some initial slice because the field equations for x are just those of a scalar field. So in particular, you can choose initial data that has some compact support far away from the boundary of ADS. This means that you don't care if you've used these Poincaré coordinates. You just pick initial data that lives somewhere inside your coordinate patch. Doesn't get near the boundary, so you can't exclude it by boundary conditions. This is just some little genuinely local perturbation, and it's a local perturbation of all of the components of the metric. It has negative energy. It has finite negative energy because you just choose, basically because there's nothing to diverge. You start here, you let it propagate. In a finite amount of time, it will reach the boundary of ADS. And then with the boundary conditions that make the most sense, reflects off, reaches the boundary again in a finite amount of time. When it reaches the boundary, it looks as if generically one of the fluctuations, one of the components of the metric fluctuation goes as 1 over z squared. This is still asymptotically anti-de Sitter, but it means that it's changing your boundary data. So there's something really strange going on in this dual conformal theory, that you're starting with nothing, 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 then suddenly things jump. They stay jumped for a little while, then they go back to nothing, 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 jump. I don't understand what this means, but it's in terms of the bulk, it's a perfectly good solution. And that's what you expect for starting with a little perturbation inside ADS and letting it go out and reach the boundary.
Sorry, this remark has nothing to do with 3D.
Yeah. Right. So I think it's an interesting question in general in ADS CFT to understand what things like this mean. It also doesn't necessarily even have anything to do with gravity, right? You can start with just an ordinary scalar field in asymptotically ADS space. And there you get avoid any problems with higher order interactions or anything like that. Now, the ADS-CFT correspondence is non-local. So there's nothing here that violates the formal statement of the ADS-CFT correspondence, which says that correlation functions out here are related to integrals of stuff on the inside along the light cones. And so, I mean, there's nothing inconsistent here, but it's something that I assume that people who have thought more about the ADS-CFT correspondence than I do have something more to say about this. But in any case, this is what seems to come out in topologically massive gravity. And what it means is that you can't get rid of these local degrees of freedom using any ordinary kinds of boundary conditions, because you can always set them up in such a way that they stay away from the boundary initially. To somehow say that you're excluding these is to use teleological boundary conditions, to say that you're excluding some initial data now because you don't like what it's going to do sometime in the future. Usually, well, you do that, people do that all the time, but they do it by saying, well, this means that the theory is unstable, because if you can do something now and it'll do something bad to you in the future, that means that it's a bad theory. Yes?
I have a naive question. Mm-hmm. The prediction from tent to the boundary, mm-hmm. I think the inner product you defined will be ill-defined.
I don't think so. It depends, depends on the boundary conditions that you choose. But
the prediction has to get to the boundary.
Yeah.
When you, as the inner product is defined on the
mm-hmm. Right.
Bug.
Yes.
So in the bug, the new perturbation. So I think when the perturbation propagates to the boundary, the inner product will be zero.
Ah, no, no. There's always some perturbation still in the bulk. If this is some finite size here, then as it propagates up here, when one edge hits the boundary, the other edge will still be in the bulk. You would have to integrate along a light-like slice to have the whole thing at the boundary.
I'm supposed to take this literally, that the support is strictly between those dotted
lines. Yeah.
It's not smeared out at all. I
mean, well, at first order. This is first order. Yes, in the linearized theory, you can certainly set it up in such a way that this is the case, yes.
Also, this was linearized, so the second order, presumably the constraints will not allow you to have something strictly object support.
Right. That's, I'll get to that in a second. Yes. This is my last slide. This is open questions and loopholes, of which that's going to be one. One question, and this is closely related to that, maybe closely related to that, is the question of how this chiral behavior at the boundary shows up in the bulk. I mean, in particular, at the boundary, one of the chiral components of the boundary stress energy tensor is zero. In principle, either you can see that in the bulk stress energy tensor, or if you can't, that tells you that you cannot get away with not going to higher orders. And having the higher orders really become significant when you get to the boundary. This is a very hard calculation. I'm in the middle of it. The basic structure seems to be related to an old result of Deser and Tekin, who showed that if you take the stress energy tensor for the perturbation in topologically massive gravity at first order, and you construct a conserved charge using a Killing vector of the background ADS phase. The effect of the Chern-Simons term is basically to keep the same structure as the Einstein stress energy tensor, but to shift the Killing vector into the Killing vector plus some combination of its derivatives. And at first order, at mu equals plus or minus 1, at mu equals plus 1, for instance, C plus shifts to 0. That's, you can just calculate that. So they could have gotten this interesting chiral structure if they had looked one step farther than they did. It's not clear at this point whether this is true at second order or at the bulk stress energy tensor, which is quadratic in the metric fluctuations. That's what I'm trying to figure out. A second interesting open question is to look at this from the outside in. That is to start with data at infinity and see how that determines a solution in the interior. This is what Pfefferman and Graham did for ordinary gravity. And what Solodukhin found was that at this chiral coupling, the lowest order equation of motion for the normal derivative of one of the components of the metric just goes away. It's multiplied by some projection operator and just goes to 0. This is presumably an indication that at this critical value, the fact that the equations are third order and not second order really matters, and that you really need to expand to higher order in the field equations to get a solution. But I'm not sure. A student and I are looking at this now. Then finally, this question of whether there's any way of saving the theory. One question is the question of linearization instability, which comes back to what you were raising, that you can certainly have compact support for your metric fluctuation at linear order. But at higher orders, we know that general relativity or anything like general relativity won't allow that, that there's got to be some piece that stretches all the way out to infinity. It is conceivable that although there are these linearized solutions, that they can't be extended to infinity at higher order. There's no particular reason to believe that this is true, except that it's a really nice theory and it would be nice if you could save it. But I can't say it's not true. A second possibility, also coming from these higher order effects, is that maybe even if the energy of these propagating fields is negative, maybe there's a lower bound. That is not quite as strange as it sounds. If you look at if you look at 2 plus 1 dimensional gravity without a cosmological constant, for instance, there is in fact a lower bound on energy. Because basically when you put a mass into a spacetime, it becomes conical with a deficit angle that depends on the mass. And if you put too much mass in, it folds up into a sphere and your asymptotic boundary disappears. It could be, it seems unlikely to me at this point, but it's possible that some kind of higher order effect puts a bound on the negative energies. And as long as there's a lower bound, we're fine. Those are the only two ways that I can see that the theory might still survive. And as I said, they don't seem very likely to me, but I can't rule them out. Finally, let me raise one more question, which is about the case of a vanishing cosmological constant, where it's generally believed that this theory is fine. It's certainly true that you don't have black holes in that case. And so you don't have competition of positive and negative energies in the way that you do with the negative cosmological constant. On the other hand, even with lambda equals zero, you can create topological configurations, for instance, wormholes, that have energies. And you can ask whether those have negative energies relative to the topologically massive excitations. And if so, whether ordinary topologically massive gravity, even with a vanishing cosmological constant, is in danger. It may be here that this trick that there's a limit to the amount of mass that you can put into a spacetime becomes important. And if that's true, that would be interesting. That would say that somehow the topology of space saves you from having the theory go bad. So that's where things stand now, as far as I know. So let me stop here.
We're going to have much time for questions. I think we have a couple of questions.
Yeah, Kristen and I have been looking at this recently because this paper we wrote on 3D gravity, some people asked if our no geons applies here. What we found is the solutions that are known for black holes and that all violate the canonical energy conditions. So you don't have any area theorems or singularity theorems. So basically, you have to think back to negative energy caused from the quantum tensor solutions. We checked the AF case and the
ABS. Ah.
Okay. And so the other thing is they have to, since they're, you know, if they obeyed the energy conditions, they would be, you know, we have a theorem which says there isn't anything. Mm-hmm. So then, you know, they obviously violate the conditions of the theorem.
Right. But is this different for topologically massive gravity than it is for plain Einstein gravity? Okay. Okay. I definitely want to talk to you.
So there seems to be this energy violation that people don't realize.
Maybe time
instability. It may be instability in a sort of a nonlinear fashion.
That would be very interesting to know. Yeah. Andy is hoping for linearization instability. His, at least the last I heard from him, which was a couple of months ago, what his hope was that the bulk stress energy tensor would be non-zero, that this would require an additional contribution from higher order terms, and that that additional higher order contribution would have to diverge somewhere.
You couldn't produce the perturbation of zero energy.
I don't think so.
But then you might argue whether you want. It doesn't necessarily imply any modification of zero.
Yeah. That's an interesting question. I mean, it's an open. Well, there are two things to say about that. One is that the behavior that this behavior near infinity that I've seen is you have two separate pieces of initial data, the field and its first derivative, and it seems true that the generic behavior diverges as 1 over z squared at infinity, but I don't yet know whether there's some way of picking the two pieces of data in such a way that there's a cancellation. The other thing to say about this is that this divergence near infinity doesn't really mean that the theory is going bad near infinity. There, it clearly means that the linearized approximation is breaking down because the higher powers of the linear perturbation become important. So even if you're willing to adopt these teleological boundary conditions and say, I'm going to reject all solutions that become bad at infinity in the future, then all you can say is that you don't know what to do with the theory because there are solutions which might or might not become bad at infinity.
Professor Carlin will be around tomorrow, the whole day, so